reached this poem in error, please check with the operator and try again. You have reached this poem in error. Please check with the operator and try again. You have reached this poem in error. Please check with the operator and try again. You have reached this poem in error. Please check with the operator and try again. And the poem is a loop that consists of repeating and reading that one sentence over and over again. After about 40 or so seconds, the poem begins to break down and kind of get mixed up. Reach this poem, 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 in error, in error, in error, in error, in error. After it goes on like that for a certain amount of time, the voice begins to become distorted, you know, like electronically distorted until you can't understand it anymore. And the poem finally ends. I'm sure, I know Charles very well, and I know that, he, as far as I know, he's never done meditation practice. He actually doesn't mind if other people do meditation. It doesn't bother him, but he himself would never do meditation because he is against clarity of mind. He thinks it's a bad idea. He also feels that his anxieties and neuroses are dear to him, and he doesn't want to do anything that might endanger him. So he's not interested in meditation at all. However, his telephone poem seems very apt to me as a lifelong meditator. You have reached this poem in error. Please check with the operator and try again. As you listen to this, with each repetition, it becomes a little different. At first, you might think it's clever and witty, but as it goes on and on and on without changing at all, even as it's sort of changing in you as you listen to it going on and on and on, it becomes more and more and more disturbing. And maybe at some point it even seems oppressive and annoying. You can't believe this is all it is, just repeating the same thing over and over and over again. Until finally it breaks down altogether. And you hardly even recognize the voice anymore. Yes, somehow Charles understands meditation practice very, very well. Even though he's never done it. Those of you who've meditated for a long time can relate to what I'm saying. So, let me say a little bit more about meditation practice. In the Eightfold Buddhist Path, three of the eight members of the path have to do with meditation. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. In the meditation practice that we do, we're actually practicing all three of these. Right effort means that when we sit down, we make a commitment to ourselves and to everybody else who's sitting with us in the room that we're going to be serious about the practice. It's as if every time we sit down and make a vow to ourselves that we're going to sit here and we're really going to work on being present, coming back over and over again to the present, to the breath, to the body. We sit with that intention. And we monitor our practice, right? When we drift, we come back. So right effort is really important. That it be not too loose, not too tight, not too tense. We can be too serious, you know, sitting there meditating, but we can be not serious enough, right? So we really have to find a right balance in our effort. It's a little bit like hold a teacup that's pretty full, if you hold it too tight, too tense, you're going to spill it. If you hold it too loosely, you'll spill it. You just have to hold it just right, the right amount of attention and tension. So that's right effort. Right mindfulness is paying attention with a loving mindfulness, a loving honesty to what's happening in the moment. Not rejecting what's happening, not trying to adjust it, not having too many judgments about it, not complaining about it too much, or pretending that it's not happening, but just being aware of what is actually happening with a loving attention. When we pay attention to the body, we also are able, with a greater degree of expansiveness, to pay attention to the mind and the heart. Right concentration, you could view as an intensification of right mindfulness. In sitting meditation practice, it means that once in a while, anyway, you're really able to stay with attention to the body and the breath thoroughly without too much distraction, maybe with real one-pointed concentration. That you can be strong and calm with body and breath and with the present moment, nothing else going on, and then you can intensify that, strengthen it, until you actually can go beyond paying attention to the body and breath. There's nothing else but presence. And then, not even that. In our Zen practice, we don't usually make too big a deal out of concentration. But of course, it is important to us. Sometimes, when concentration is strong, and there's also a spirit of investigation, there can come, you know, a moment of real insight when you can see with your whole body, quite directly and personally, something that you've never seen before. Something basic and true about our human life. That most of the time, without that degree of concentration, you just can't see. The traditional way of talking about what it is that you see is that you see impermanence, you see unself, and you see suffering. In other words, in a moment of concentration, you see what your life really is, the way it's always been, but now you see your life in time, in space. You see that time is passing all the time, and it's always been passing, that there is no substance, that everything is just passing, nothing remains. And nothing and no one is here in the first place. And this is very liberating. It might seem not liberating, but when you experience it, it's very liberating because you realize all your problems are basically fictitious. You've been creating all your problems in the first place. This fiction is extremely convincing, as we can all attest, but it is a fiction. And now you've seen through it. And you need some concentration to really see through it at that level. What I'm saying is easy to understand and appreciate, but it's something else to really see it with your whole body and your whole heart. And in order to see it, you really need to develop some concentration. And that's why we value concentration and why it's important. So these three, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, they have to do with one another. They support one another. They're really, the three of them together are what we call our meditation practice. Each one is important in its own right, but together they're even more important. The more concentration there is, the more mindfulness there will be. The more mindfulness there will be, the easier it is to develop concentration. The more mindfulness and concentration that you have, the more inspired and powerful and sustained will your effort be. And on, they all go together. So, in the Vipassana tradition, in the Zen tradition, we focus on meditation. You could think that meditation is the whole of Buddha Dharma, but remember, there's eight members of the Eightfold Path. That's just three of them. There are five others. Right view, right intention, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood. If you think about what these amount to, they have to do with how we think about things, how we act, both on a personal level and in society. And traditionally, it's said that these five practices are necessary for us to develop and engage before we even take up meditation practice. That there would be no point in practicing meditation if you are not paying attention to your view of life and to your conduct. That the meditation practice actually wouldn't work. And the reverse is true as well. When you practice meditation, you can't avoid noticing that a bad view and bad conduct is painful and confining. Meditation practice sort of ruins your life in that regard, you know, because you were going along just fine before with your kind of like half-hearted, kind of shaky life, and it was all okay. But then you start meditating and you realize this is not okay. This is worse than I thought it was. This is really painful, my life. It's really painful. I knew it was not so great before, but now I'm going nuts. I hate this. It's terrible. Meditation practice sort of ruins you that way. It makes a shoddy life increasingly uncomfortable and ultimately impossible. But this is the sneaky thing about both the Vipassana tradition and Zen, where you just come in and they say, meditate. They don't tell you that this is going to wreck your life. It allows you to change so much in your life that you'll hardly recognize yourself some distance down the road. Practice causes you eventually, inevitably, to re-examine your basic worldview and to be way more careful and aware of your conduct. Somehow, just by breathing and paying attention to your body, this all takes place. It's quite a natural process. And the more you sit, the more subtly you will be examining your view and your conduct. So I hope that everybody here has had a chance once in a while to experience a little bit of concentration. You don't need much. Maybe like 1 second or 10 seconds would be enough to see something that you've never seen before, or to see again and again what you have seen. It's very moving, really. What are you seeing? You're just seeing this moment of your life. It's a nice feeling. This moment of your life is enough. You don't need more. Just just this twilight sky, just this tree, just this sensation in the body, just this thought arising in the mind, just this person. And in this simple moment of being willing to be completely absorbed and satisfied, you feel somehow that everything is included, not a single thing is left out. No interpretation is necessary. No interpretation is even possible. It's just a moment. That's all it is. It's gone. And you let it go. You realize that even as it was there, it was already gone. Anyway, it's not the sort of thing that you could hold on to. You can't really hold on to your life. And the fact that we're always desperately trying to do that is why we're suffering. And since we are suffering, we're always suffering together. Once you see this, you feel a lot of love and compassion. Because look at us, you know, we're all doing this together. It's so sad and wondrous and fabulous. This phenomena of living and dying together. So, I think the title of my talk is something like Meditation, William Blake in Japan. So now, part two, William Blake. I don't know how much you all know about William Blake, but he was quite an interesting person. And I think interesting to us now because he was living at the very beginning of the world that we live in now. The very beginning of the Industrial Revolution, which started in England. And he was English, living in London. The whole traditional world that had existed for centuries was just at this moment of Blake's life beginning to fade away. In a new world of efficiency and production, the world we live in now was beginning. Before that time, peasants worked hard and died young. The high-born classes enjoyed their social lives. And everybody accepted their given lot in life as just the way it was. The way things were was the way they had always been. And they would always be that way. Everyone agreed. There was a certain amount of suffering, but suffering was expected. That was just part of what you live as a human being. And it would never be any other way. But all of a sudden, factories started springing up all over London. And before you know it, London, which had, you know, animals in the streets and trees, became covered with soot and then a fog of factory fumes. Then the railroad came and the world began to be a different world, and people's expectations and feelings began to be different. Blake hated all these changes. He thought they were making a literal hell on earth. He looked around at London, the smoke from the factories and the fires, and he thought he was living in hell. However, he wasn't a conservative either. He was just as critical of the previous period as he was of the period that was coming. Because he felt that the old social order was way too repressive, way too restrictive, and way too unfair. He thought that human beings were put on the earth to be equal to one another, that there should be no barriers between social classes, and that the reason people existed was to know joy and delight and union with the divine. And that human beings had to stop being ruled by tyrants within and without and just open up. So believe it or not, at this time, in the early 18th century, Blake was against all this and was in favor of free love, free expression, the full equality of women, and of people of other races, unheard of at that time. To say that Blake was ahead of his time is an understatement. He loved Jesus, and he loved the Bible, but he hated organized Christianity. He thought that organized Christianity was just as soul-killing as the factories and the child labor. And all of this you hear in his poems. His passionate rejection of everything that everybody else took to be normal. He thought the world was crazy. And mostly the world thought he was crazy. Here's one of his poems. O Rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies through the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love doth thy life destroy. A chilling poem. What does Blake mean? What is the rose? Well, I don't know. It's maybe a lot of different things. But maybe we could say the rose is our precious, delicate, beautiful human life. The miracle of any one of us being born and being sentient. And there's some kind of a worm, an invisible worm, right at the heart of that rose. A sneaky, destructive worm full of biblical energy that has implicated its way into the heart of the rose where it sleeps, where the rose is sleeping in its crimson joy, not knowing that this worm is in there. Blake was so steeped in the Bible, maybe the worm was his way of talking about sin. Some force deep within us. Buddha might have defined it perhaps more psychologically as clinging, or more philosophically as misknowledge or misunderstanding. But Blake was a poet and an artist, and I feel sure he must have had an actual image that he saw, you know, in his mind's eye of a rose and a worm. And I'm sure that this viscerally affected him. He saw this worm of destructiveness all around him. And I'm sure he saw it in himself too. And his dark secret love doth thy life destroy. I don't know if you've noticed that line. Surprising. We think of the bad guy, the worm in this case, as not at all being motivated by love, but here this worm is motivated by love, dark secret love. And that really is, to me, the genius of the poem. The worm is propelled by love, just as every evil is propelled by love gone wrong, love wounded and twisted by suffering and ignorance, love that's secret and dark and can't find open expression. One more Blake poem. This is called London. I wandered through each chartered street, near where the chartered Thames does flow, a mark in every face I meet, marks of weakness, marks of woe. In every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every van, the mind-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most, through midnight streets I hear how the youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear and blights with plague the marriage hearse. This is a pretty bleak poem. And this is what Blake saw, and this is what he felt in the early part of the 19th century. The very end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century. That's what he saw in London. All the streets, even the river, chartered under the control of the tyrant. Everything oppressive and everyone affected by it, full of weakness and woe and bound by mind-forged manacles. You might have heard that phrase before. It's a very famous phrase of Blake's, mind-forged manacles. Blake was possibly the first person to recognize that economic and social forces become internalized. They get built into the structures of our personality. So that in the end, you know, what binds us is our own mind. It took people like Freud and Foucault and many others in the 20th century to flesh out this idea so that we could understand it. But the Buddha already understood it. But still today, we have our chimney sweepers cry, in the cries, or the lack of cries, of farm workers or factory workers or indentured slave construction workers in foreign countries. It's kind of unfair, horrendous labor practices that are in play so that the products that we use every day can be affordable for us. And we still have the hapless soldiers whose blood still runs down palace walls. The last stanza of the poem is a little, last line, so it's a little bit surprising. It begins, but most, in other words, the worst of all this, is the sexual oppression of young girls. whose poverty forces them into prostitution and kills childhood itself and love itself. And marriage, the highest hope and vehicle and promise for love, becomes, as he says, a hearse. It would be nice to think that this had ended, but it hasn't ended. We still have it in our world. Well, Blake was actually a happily married man. He was married for many, many years, decades, to his wife, Catherine Boucher, who was illiterate when they married. They're actually somewhere in the archive, you know, is their marriage certificate, which is signed by her with an X, because she couldn't write her name. Blake himself only went as far as the 10th grade, but he actually taught her to read and write, and he taught her how to be an engraver. That was his trade. He had apprenticed himself, you know, as a young boy, to an engraver. He was a great engraver, a great artist, and a lot of his masterworks of engraving actually are really collaborations between him and Catherine, who he loved dearly. And he had a hard life, like you can imagine, right? With his views, and he was not at all shy about expressing them. He had a pretty hard life. And I think the only thing that kept him going was Catherine's support. And he was really grateful for it. The story goes that on the day of Blake's death, sort of half, conscious and ready to die, he suddenly leaped up in bed and cried out, "Kate, I will draw your portrait, for you have been an angel to me." And he suddenly got out of bed, and he did just that. He drew her portrait. Then, engraving, then set down his tools and burst into song and began singing hymns and biblical verses for the rest of the day. And at 6 that evening, after promising his wife that he would always be with her, he perished. Anyway, that's the story. So, Blake, we're indebted to Blake, actually, because Blake was possibly the main influence on Allen Ginsberg. And Allen Ginsberg saw in our time what Blake saw in his time. And to a tremendous extent, what Allen lived and thought came from Blake. And as we know, the Beat Writers made a big impact on our culture. And all of them, all the Beat Writers, were interested in Buddhism as a coping mechanism to deal with this crazy world, but also as a cultural intervention. And many of them were quite serious about it. Allen practiced Buddhism seriously the rest of his life. Phil Whalen became a Zen priest. Kerouac wrote a book about Buddhism. Many, many people in their generation were pioneers of the Buddhism that we are able to practice now because of them. So, thanks to William Blake, who got us all started. Truth of suffering was pretty apparent to him. Part 3, Japan. So in 2010, I took some everyday Zen degrees and senior students on a pilgrimage to Japan. And we went to the Suzuki Roshi's temple in a small, relatively small fishing town on top of the mountain. And we went to the two big headquarters monasteries of Soto Zen. And we did a bunch of ceremonies. We had fun. So this is a book. It's a book-length diary poem about the trip, and I'll read a little bit of it for you. It's written in very short lines, and so I'm going to try to indicate through the way I read. So if the way I read sounds funny, it's because I'm following the scoring of the poem on the page. I'd had a thought, then, now, gone. Can't think of it, that thought, yet thoughts shape and memory linger still in me, impressions of that which had occurred in thought, in fact, is thought as thought fact, fact of the matter. Those curved roofs, thoughts result. That shrouded statue and feeling, thoughts result. First thought, then deed, and artifact, past, time, less. You can't argue with that. This. Then thought remembered, thought forgotten, thought frozen in wood, stone, paint, trace of person, they undergo austerities, stay pure, vow not to leave mountain 12 years, hear their voices inside. Raked pathways, curved lines, some thinking what? Don't go there. Silent, respect, do not enter, do not leave. Path down, steep stone steps, I recall monastery stones, no stories, no one's thought illumined, just that light. Of text the nation. You believe that, so it is so. Still, killing, injustice, seems no tomorrow there. Blood's bright moisture shining. And skipping. One of the themes of this book is the fact that if you go to Japan, the practice of Zen in Japan, as it is the practice of Buddhism all over Asia, I think this is true everywhere in Asia, it's really about the past. The Buddhism in Asia is an ancient tradition. And to preserve Buddhism is to preserve the past. And the main reason to do Buddhism is to do it so as to preserve the past. And it's quite different here, isn't it? We have no past. We have no Buddhist past. So that's not what we're concerned about at all. So one of the themes of the book is about how the difference between the practice in Japan and the practice here. So you'll see that in this little final passage. And they, in Japan, they often, as you'll see in this next part, they, founders of temples and important people, their statues are venerated, food is offered to them and so on for generations. When you are dead, things improve. People feed you, bow to you, bring many treats, respect their Daily activity maintains your memory, and you don't have to sweat in summer, freeze in winter, eat or poop, talk, get your feelings hurt, get mad, disgusted, feel tired, sick. You don't have to die. In this world, we take care of, honor our dead, the whole of our activity dedicated to them. Our life keeps the past alive. In this world, another world, we figure out new things to do. We figure the past is dead and gone. What use could it possibly have now unless it tells us a better way to live, or is maybe material for a theme park or interesting tourist spot? The past was fine, but we have to live our lives now. We have problems. So, I realized with some start, which probably you didn't notice, but I noticed it internally, that as far as I can remember, we didn't sit, did we? I thought we would sit first, and that was what you thought too. But I forgot. Yeah, that's what happens when you... yes, when you introduced me, you said I was one of the beat poets. And I'm elderly, but I'm not that old. I'm kind of thinking that I'm older. But it would appear that I'm old enough to forget that when it's time to sit, I'm just, old people just sort of blather on without noticing anything else that's going on. Have you noticed that with your elderly parents or grandparents? They're blathering on. So, why don't I stop talking now? And let's do this. Let's all stand up for a brief moment, take a break, and then let's do a short sit, and then we can talk, discuss. All right? So let's maintain the silence now.
And just going on to the next one, because it's kind of a confusing question. At its heart, it's my readings of the suttas and many stories that I hear of Buddha's time is that people were liberated right and left by the hundreds. And today, that seems like a rare experience if it exists at all today. And I get confused about why. I sit here and wonder if the techniques of samsara or oppression have just evolved more quickly than the techniques of liberation. And as somebody who spent so much time in one of the most sophisticated sanghas in the U.S. at the Zen Center, in that 50-year tradition, being with people who are fully committed to trying to liberate in this lifetime, do you have any thoughts about why does it almost feel like the mountain that we have to climb to liberation has gotten higher over time?
Actually, the acoustics in this room seem pretty good. And could you hear his question?
Yes.
I think everybody could hear. And thank you for speaking up with a loud voice. And is that okay that I don't repeat the question? Is there something about a recording? Whoever was telling me I should repeat the question. Is it all right if I don't? Well, I guess so. Well, that's a great question. And you can imagine I've thought about this before. And also, I don't know the answer. But I can share some of my thoughts with you. maybe two thoughts I have that are possibly relevant to your question is, first of all, I am highly aware of the fact that the Buddhist scriptures, like all scriptures and all written documents, are literary documents. In other words, to take them literally at face value and think that they're describing the same kinds of things that we would be thinking about every day, seeing every day, is probably unrealistic. They're literary documents. You mentioned that in Buddhist time people were getting liberated right and left. Well, then you must be aware of the many times in the suttas when people get liberated on the spot without ever practicing. They see the Buddha, and the Buddha just says to them, you know, something, and they become liberated on the spot, right? So, what are we to make of those stories? Are they fictitious? Are they, when they say liberation, do they mean something other than what we think liberation is? What do they really mean? So that's one whole set of questions and reflections. Another one is, we can see in our own time, I can see the difference between the sense of self, the psychology of an average person in this generation that I'm in. I can see a difference between a generation ago and two generations ago. I mean, I knew, I grew up living with my grandmother, so I knew her very well. She had a very different sense of what it meant to be a person and alive than my parents did. And I have a different sense from what they did. So we're talking now about 2,500 years ago or more. What were these people like? How did they, we can't really imagine. We really don't know what it was like, what the subjectivity of a person who lived 2,500 years ago or more was. We really can't, there's no way that if we project ourselves back to that, there is no way that we're not projecting our own sense of being a person onto what. So in other words, there's no way that we could really understand what they meant by liberation and what they experienced, even if those stories are true. They're also, the early suttas are full of stories about gods and deities who figure very prominently in many, many of the stories. What are we supposed to think about that? Why would we say the part about the liberation is really true, but the part about the deity is just not really true? Right? Which is what we do, isn't it? We read those stories and we say, well, the person was liberated in such and such a way. I believe that part. But the deities and this and that, I don't really believe in that. Or do you believe in that? And then how do you, what does it mean to you? So there are many problems with reading ancient texts. So that's why we have contemporary teachers in every generation. Because that's what we need to effectively practice in every generation. We need to help each other out and figure out the appropriate practice and the appropriate way of holding the Buddha Dharma in the generation that, that we're living in. There's no doubt in my mind that if you read the early suttas and develop a conception of what you think liberation is from those suttas, and then you try to practice in such a way that you will experience or hold exactly that conception, this will not be successful. I think it's inevitably impossible to project an idea of liberation from an unliberated perspective and then to try to achieve that liberation that you invented will never work, right? Inevitably. So I think we have to think carefully about what are we trying to do here. I myself feel pretty confident that the teaching and practice of the Buddha is sound, and that it does reduce our suffering, and it does liberate us from unthinking, unexamined self-clinging. But I myself don't believe that living the lives that we live with the kind of subjectivity that we have, the idea of some kind of pure, blissful, unstained mind, I don't think that's a reasonable goal. I think it's kind of lead us to be frustrated or constantly be trying to attain the unattainable for our entire life of practice, which to me is sad. I think we can practice and we can be transformed and we can be liberated, but we will remain, my belief, we will remain ourselves. We will remain conditioned by our social and personal conditioning. But we will be able to be free within that condition. We will not throw it off, and it will not dissolve and disappear. Furthermore, we wouldn't want it to. Would we want to go around being pure Buddhas? Really? It'd be so lonely. Right? There probably are like a few really enlightened people around, and I feel sorry for them. I mean, like, they would be missing out on so much. Like, they would not really be able to experience, you know, grief when they lost somebody that they loved. If they were so enlightened that they were beyond that, I wouldn't be able to experience that, and that would be too bad. As far as I'm concerned, that would be too bad. They wouldn't be able to read the newspaper and feel upset when bad things are happening. And to me, that would be too bad. I don't want to lose that ability. So, in other words, I think we really need to think about how we're practicing and what we're really trying to do. And I think my guess is that everybody in this room, except for maybe someone who just came in the first time, if I asked you, has practice helped your life? Has it made a difference in your life? You would say, yes, it has. It's made a big difference in my life. I feel much better, you know, living my life now that I'm practicing than I did before. I think most people would say that. If I said, have you achieved perfect liberation? Probably nobody in the room, myself included, would say, yes, I have. So this is good. We have a horizon to go toward. That's what the sutras are telling us, I think. These early sutras are telling us. There's a horizon to go to. Don't be complacent that you now understand Buddhism. You understand Buddhist teaching. You keep going for your whole life through toward that horizon. And that's the joy of practice, to learn more, deepen. And there's no end to it. I don't think there's an end to it. I don't think there's a line in the sand called nirvana. And that's the end. We keep on going forever and ever, lifetime after lifetime. So anyway, that's a great question. Thank you. And so, I don't know the answer, but those are my thoughts for now.
Yeah.
Isn't the title of your book something about escaping this crazy life of tears?
Escape this crazy life of tears, yeah. Yeah.
So how about the escape part? We're usually taught in Zen, right, not to try to escape. So could you say a little bit about that?
By the way, this is Jeff Kelly, who's the priest of our Seattle Soto Zen gang. So if you ever become interested in checking out Seattle Soto Zen, there's your guy. And I have a problem with prejudice, but he's a really good guy. Escape this crazy life of tears is a quote from, I can't remember now, I wish I could find the page, I would read it for you, but I think we visited an abbot who maybe said that, escape this crazy life of tears. Well, you escape and you don't escape, right? I mean, I think that you could say, I mean, it's a typical trope in Asian Buddhism that you do escape. You go to the monastery because your life is shattered. You know, there's that famous movie, The Burmese Harp, or The Harp of Burma, whatever it is, it's about World War II. And at the end of the movie, the soldier in World War II who's been wandering around, you know, in a horrible, war-torn Asian country, at the end, goes to a monastery. And probably you didn't know that, because I didn't know this till I read about it, that did you know that during World War II and after, in the 10 years or so after World War II, the Catholic monasteries in the United States were full to the brim with people who wanted to be monastics. They were sleeping in the corridors, literally. They were in cots in the corridors of almost every American monastery because soldiers coming back from the war didn't know what to do with their lives if they weren't somehow connected. And so they had a religious calling. So, yes, I mean, and then it's just funny, I was just thinking about it. You know, it's the Jewish New Year. So I call up my family members, you know, and I don't see them very often, they're far away. And I was just struck by, there's so much suffering. And these are ordinary, like regular middle-class people. These are not disadvantaged people. But so much suffering. So yes, this world is a world to be escaped from. Let's face it. I always feel like, you know, maybe people come to practice Buddhism because they think it's interesting or it can improve their life or something like that. And I think people who come with that motivation usually don't last that long. It's not worth it. It's not worth the effort. You don't improve your life that much. The only way that it's worth the effort is if you're desperate. You're trying to escape. And so either people who come just for the fun of it, just it's kind of interesting, either they realize that actually they really came because of suffering, or they don't stay very long. Anybody, whenever I sit, like I'm sitting now, I'm looking out at a room full of people who are practicing Buddhism, I realize I'm looking out at a room full of desperate people. Yeah, there's a desperate people who are trying to escape this crazy world. But then the trick part is, and this is the part that you're bringing up, the trick part is that how do you escape the crazy world? You escape the crazy world in the recognition that there is no escape. And that by really and truly seeing your life and being your life, facing the suffering of the world and of your own heart, that's how you escape. That's the liberation that we're seeking, right? It is to escape this world by being in this world. To become liberated by not searching for liberation that's unattainable. So I think escape this crazy life of tears is I think a commonplace Japanese phrase. I don't think this abbot invented it. I think it's a commonplace Japanese phrase to talk about practice. Yeah, so So we're not running, even if you go to a monastery, you're not running off to a monastery. In Zen, as you know, we don't live in monasteries. Mostly we train there for a certain amount of time. And people like me who stayed for many, many years are there to help other people, to preserve the space, right, for other people. Because there really is no escape from the body and mind of a human being in a world other than embracing this world. Do you want to say more about it? What you had in mind?
You said it very, very well.
Thanks. Thank you for coming tonight. Nice to see you. Anything else? Yes?
This is a question concerning the enlightened person you mentioned earlier. Concerning the enlightened person earlier, you felt sorry for it.
Yeah.
Would that be considered almost bad karma to be enlightened right now?
Would it be, I'm sorry, to be bad karma to be what?
Enlightened at this point. Say someone like you would feel sorry for an enlightened person.
No, I don't think it would be bad karma to be enlightened now. I think it would be wonderful for that person. Don't you?
Well, why would you feel sorry for someone's enlightenment?
Well, I'm just speaking as a normal, regular person, thinking to myself that there are many things about my unenlightenment that I really value, is what I'm saying. And if an enlightened person wouldn't be able to appreciate these unenlightened things, then I would feel sorry for them for that reason. But probably from their own point of view, they wouldn't feel mine, so they'd probably be happy, I guess. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah. Did I answer your question?
Sure.
Okay, good. That's what we like. Satisfied. What's that?
It's temporary.
Temporary, yeah. I know every product wears out and then you have to buy another one. That's what you like also. Temporary satisfaction is better than permanent satisfaction. Yeah. Yes? Well, I think both. It's a little complicated. One way of looking at, say, the difference between Buddhism and those other religions that you mentioned is that Buddhism doesn't require, at least the way we understand it, practicing here, it doesn't require a set of beliefs. So a person could come and say, well, I'm not a Buddhist, and I'm not interested in Buddhism, but I think this is a good practice, the meditation and so on, and it helps me. So do you mind if I come here and practice it? Most places they would say, oh, no, most of the people here are like that, so that's fine. You don't have to believe in Buddhism. Sometimes people come and say, well, I believe in Islam, or I believe in Judaism or Christianity, but I want to come and do the practice here, and then that's perfectly okay. It's more okay in Buddhism than it might be in other religions where you'd be expected to have a certain set of beliefs or fealties and so on. So in that sense, Buddhism, because it doesn't have a God that one should be believing in to be in that religion, it's a pretty open situation. And so you could practice Buddhism as a way of life and not as a religion.
So pretty chill.
Pardon me?
Pretty chill.
Pretty chill. You could feel a little bit relaxed. Yeah. On the other hand, Buddhism does have scriptures. It has rituals. At least the kind of Buddhism that I practice does. I'm an ordained priest. You know, it has the whole nine yards that all religions have. So you would have to conclude that it is a religion that someone could make use of, even if they're not a member of the religion. Although I think in Vipassana, the tradition that's represented in this place, they've removed a lot of the Asian religious trappings. So it's more arguable that American Vipassana tradition is less religious, so to speak, than Zen or Tibetan Buddhism. Why do you ask that question? Are you considering taking up the practice of Buddhism, or do you do it already?
I'm just asking.
Oh.
I'm just thinking of a question.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, Buddhism is, in its essence, very tolerant, you know? It's very open and tolerant, essentially. It doesn't propose, this is absolutely true, you must believe this. However, the truth of the matter is, if you were to go to a church, and there's 50 people sitting in the pew, let's say, and you actually interviewed all 50 of them in depth, you would probably discover that not a single one of them believes what they're supposed to believe. Yes?
Do you believe that all suffering is self-imposed?
Do I believe that all suffering is self-imposed? Well, of course, that raises the question, what exactly does one mean by suffering?
Correct.
Yeah. So, no, I would not say that all suffering is self-imposed. I mean, in some ultimate way, of course it is, because if you weren't here, you wouldn't be suffering. If you were gone, and you didn't exist, the suffering that you feel also would not exist. So ultimately, of course, the cause of suffering is that you exist. Otherwise, your suffering doesn't exist. So in that sense, and in other deep senses, we are the cause of our own suffering. But of course, there's social suffering and suffering imposed on us by other individuals. And, you know, there's poverty, there's war, there's oppression. And to say that all those forms of suffering are self-imposed and don't really matter, other than it's only in your mind, would be kind of a monstrous thought, don't you think? Seems to me that it would be. Yeah. But let's take someone who is in prison. Let's pretend that this person in prison is wrongly in prison. They're in jail for 25 years and they didn't do the crime that they were convicted for having committed, which happens a lot, right? That person would then be faced with a choice. They would say, well, I'm suffering because I'm in jail. That's why I'm suffering. And that's not my fault. That's imposed on me by other people. Now, I can nurse that thought for the next 25 years. And then I could go mad at the injustice of it. Or I could study my own heart and mind, make use of the situation I'm in, and liberate myself from this prison within. Take responsibility for this suffering, even though I didn't cause it. So there's that. That happens too, right? So we have a lot more. So in other words, from the point of view of inside the individual, you and me, it's much better for us to think that our suffering is self-imposed. Because then, that very self can be liberated from the suffering. If I think that the suffering is imposed by others that I cannot control, I'm doomed to the suffering forever, right? So that's the beauty of our practice, is that it does say to us, we have the power, no matter how bad our situation is, we have the power to liberate ourselves from this suffering, no matter how it comes to us, we can liberate ourselves from it. And sometimes that's our only hope. So, it isn't that it's true that it's self-imposed or not true. What's important is, What's the best way for us to look at it for our own well-being and for the well-being of all of us? What's the best way to look at it? Sometimes one way, sometimes another way. How's that? Does that speak to what you're raising? Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wish that I could answer all these questions really simply and say yes, no. You know? I wish I could, but that would always be wrong. And anyway, I just don't think that way, I guess. Yes?
I have a question about the Mahayana and the Bodhisattva vow.
Yeah.
I'm more in the Vipassana tradition for quite a while. I'm curious about how that embrace of the compassionate side of the Dharma plays itself out in your practice.
Uh-huh.
Or in other words, when do you decide to turn back toward the world as opposed to toward the self and the self's liberation and try to help out? How does that balance play out?
Well, as I feel it, it's the same thing. There isn't an either or 50% here, 50% there, or 20% here, and 80% there, anything like that. There's always, because my self and the world are not two different things, right? I mean, I really, from a Mahayana Buddhist point of view, that's what the Buddha meant when he taught anatta. He meant that there is no separable inner possession called me. I am made up of everything that is around me. So compassion is inside and outside. I have to just turn toward wherever I see suffering at any given moment. So compassion is the same thing as all of practice is really compassion. From the point of view of our tradition, Zen, Mahayana Buddhism. But, you know, we're living, in terms of Buddhist practice, our times are unprecedented in the sense that we have so many different kinds of Buddhism from so many different countries and cultures and historical periods side by side with each other. It is very obvious that every one of them is influenced by every other one of them. So I would not say, for example, that American Vipassana is not a Mahayana tradition. I wouldn't say that. I would say that I think all of Western Buddhism is Mahayana Buddhism, or anyway, a Buddhism that references compassion as a fundamental value. I would say there is no Buddhism that doesn't do that. So, in that sense, I'm going to say that there's a difference in style, difference in way of talking, and so on and so on. But fundamentally, what I've just said, I think, is just as true, in my opinion, of Vipassana as it is of Zen or Mahayana Buddhism. But last time I was here, I was talking about my book, Training in Compassion, which is all about how meditation practice is about compassion, right? Looking, being with our own mind is about compassion. Every encounter with another human being or with anything that appears to be outside of our body is always an encounter in compassion. So the whole practice is only about compassion.